Oak session number 14053, reel 1.
Mr. Henderson, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Romsey, in Hampshire, in 1932. I was born on a farm, and then later on moved down to Bournemouth with my my family, and that's where my real home is, in Bournemouth.
For a living?
He was a jeweller. He worked for a firm called Meaders in Boscombe, and his job was to make rings and set stones. And as a Brummie, he learned his trade up in Birmingham and moved down, I think, to a certain extent through ill health. And that is what he did all his life, till he died in 1951.
Did you go to school in Bournemouth?
Yes, I did. I attended the local school near us, and then moved on to Bournemouth Grammar School, I think from 1943 to 1951, ending up as a company sergeant major of the cadet corps, the captain of the 1st 11, and head boy for a very short while.
How old were you when you completed your schooling?
19.
What happened then?
Then I worked in a in a hotel in Bournemouth, just to complete some work before hoping to go to university, but not having quite got enough A-levels, I had to join up in November 1951 as a national serviceman.
Just before we go on to your national service, during the war, do you remember any bombing by the German Air Force in your area?
Yes, I do. I used to sleep in an Anderson shelter at night, and the odd plane came over. I think two incidents I can really recall is the bombing or shelling or cannon shells of the old Beals in Bournemouth. It was a Sunday, and we were in the garden, and we heard this roar of aircraft coming over above the clouds. Realising they were German, we didn't see anything, but we later learned during the day that the old Beals in Bournemouth had been cannon shelled, caught fire. Another morning, I came out to do my paper round in Bournemouth, and I happened to look up in the sky, and there was a big black aircraft up there. And suddenly I looked and saw it had iron crosses on the side of it, and realising it was a German, then suddenly puffs of smoke, obviously from the anti-aircraft fire, were around it. It then disappeared. What happened to it, I don't know. I think it had dropped a bomb that morning at a crossroads and killed a sweep going to work. Another incident was we, again in the garden, and we saw this plane, a Hurricane, I think it was, sort of turning on its wing, hurtling across, and then we heard machine gun fire, and I believe it shot a German plane down somewhere near the Swanage area. And I suppose that's about the only incidents I really remember of that time.
What was Beals?
It's the big store in Bournemouth, caters for everything, rather like a cut-down version of Harrods and all sorts. It's the classy store in Bournemouth there. They've rebuilt it now.
Department store?
It's a big department store.
Can you put a date on any of those incidents?
I can't really. I think it's maybe 1940, 41 when this actually happened. But I can't really remember a date on that, no. I do remember the war being declared and Mr. Chamberlain making that speech.
What do you remember?
On the wireless, that it was quite a nice sunny day, and we'd heard that he was going to make a speech at 11 o'clock that morning. We turned the radio on and heard the announcement that, you know, hostilities were going to begin.
You were only 7.
That's right, yes, but I remember it very, very clearly.
What effect did it have on a 7-year-old boy?
Not a great deal, I don't suppose. I understood what war was, but I didn't really understand what was going to happen and so on, because nothing really happened at that time. It was later on you suddenly heard the sirens and so on, and it didn't sink in, I don't think, at that age.
Now, you said you started your national service. Can you tell me how that came about, please?
Well, we all had to do the national service, so I duly joined up in Plymouth on the 1st of November 1951, a rainy day. We were herded into the back of the trucks and taken to Plumer Barracks in Plymouth, which doesn't exist anymore. And all I seem to remember of the first 2 weeks was turning up at the medical room and having needles stuck in me. I wonder when this was going to finish, actually. And then we had the basic training of 16 weeks. Well, November to just before Christmas, we were at Plymouth. And then after Christmas, we returned and finished our training at the old Wessex Depot in Exeter. I was a potential officer candidate, but obviously didn't fulfil all the requirements to become an officer, having failed the War Office Selection Board. I was then posted to Winchester, where we were in the holding company for a short while, and it was just before Easter 1952 that I went across and joined the 1st Battalion Royal Hampshire Regiment in Lunenburg.
Why do you think you failed the War Office Selection Board, did they tell you?
I did have a second try at it when I was a corporal, and they said I did not have a wide enough interest in things, and I accepted the fact that, the officer wasn't going to be me.
What was your attitude towards being conscripted in 51?
It was one of the things that you had to do, really. I'd no real attitude, because my grandfather and three uncles were all military people on my mother's side, nothing on my father's side, so there was a military background to my history. So it's not that I didn't enjoy it. I'd been in the cadet force at school, I liked shooting and so on. So I quite accepted the fact that I was going to go in for at least 2 years.
Where did you serve most of your national service?
In Germany, in Lunenburg. And at, I think, the end of 1952, because we were very poorly paid as national servicemen at 28 and sixpence a week, 10 shillings home to mum, didn't leave a lot to spend. So I then decided then that I was going to become a regular soldier, much to everyone's surprise, because in those days, not many people were actually changing over from national service to being a regular. But having done so, the money quite helped.
Was the British Army on the Rhine regarded as a good posting by the Army in those days?
Yes, it was, because you had the advantages of very cheap beer and all the spirits and so on, cheap cigarettes. It was quite a good life. You were abroad as a youngster. It was all different for you, and you could do what you wanted to there. You could go off to Hamburg on the rail network, which I did once. But I think people regarded it as quite a good posting and something that had to be done because of the Russian element there.
What was the attitude of the Germans towards the? What was for them an occupation army?
Quite friendly. We never found anything upsetting. What was upsetting to the Germans sometimes was made by us. When you've got a squadron of tanks hurtling across their cornfields that were almost ready for cutting, and there was no reason for it. I saw this, and that's what upset, I think, mainly the German farmers, that we did wreck, quite intentionally at times, some of their farms and fences, which we could have avoided, but otherwise, no, we found the Germans quite friendly. Of course, there was always a language barrier. Knowing the British, we don't tend to speak foreign languages, but anyone who did speak German got on famously with them.
Why should they have deliberately damaged the farmers' property?
I think it was lack of forethought. We were the occupying army, I suppose. I don't know how the tank commanders thought or anything like that, but it did, and I know the umpires, when they got there that particular day, really read the riot act to these tank people, but it was deliberate. I don't know why. I just don't. I mean, they were looking probably at the tactical situation, and they couldn't care less about the farmers and the fields and so on. But that's bygone. I think it's all changed now.
Now, Can we go on to Malaya, and can you tell me how you got your posting there, please?
Yes. We learned sometime in 1953 that we were going to be posted to Malaya for 3 years. At the end of 1953, I'd done the small arms school course at Hythe. I'd been with the regiment to Bisley, and we duly came back to Perham Down before going to Malaya. We then marched to a station, I think Luggershall Station, caught the boat train down to Southampton, and duly got on our boat out to the Far East. Looking back on the journey, we had a very bad Christmas in the Mediterranean, very, very bad weather. I don't think many Christmas dinners were eaten that day, but I managed to get mine and get in the middle of the boat and stay there. We went through the Suez Canal in those days, which was our real first taste of somewhere abroad. I woke up on the first morning to see somebody riding a camel down the side of the canal, and I thought, you know, this is definitely abroad. And we exchanged a few pleasantries with the British soldiers on the Suez banks there, such as get your knees brown, and we replied, get some overseas service in, because we were going a little bit further along than they were. We then got to Port Suez and out into the Red Sea, and I always remember that because it was so calm and very, very hot. We then passed the island of Socotra, which I think we've got a base on now out there, then out into the Arabian Sea. We then stopped at Colombo, and then we had our first taste of getting ashore, really, there. And I went to the Colombo Zoo and had a guided tour around there. Then we embarked, and from there on we went across to Singapore, when we landed in the January. We managed to get acclimatised, I think, on the boat. There was one incident on the boat. Now, my regiment is known as the Cardboard Cavaliers, or were in those days, because all the equipment and everything was squared up with cardboard. Squared up, yes. You cut pieces of cardboard to a certain length and you put it behind your vest or your shirt to make a nice front that is all square. And so a colleague of mine, Corporal Cragg, and I decided we would take the mickey out of the regiment, much to our cost, that we had a fancy dress parade. So we used boot polish tins for cap badges, and we had our packs with labels on the back, Blanco and Brasso, and we carried a little banner between us saying the 1st Battalion, the Royal Blanco and Brasso Regiment. The RSM was duly sent for, and I can picture him now with his tongue in his cheek saying, you'll be the first two on guard at Nee Soon. And we were. I still see this gentleman, Mr. Ron Wotton, and always have a bit of a joke with him about this particular incident. Having got to Singapore, we realised we were in a totally different culture. I can still remember lines of elderly Chinese ladies who were coolies, walking round the docks and so on, carrying various items. We got off the docks into our troop-carrying vehicles and up to Nee Soon Army Camp, where we were duly billeted in these long huts. And it was rather strange that there was no glass. There was no blankets on the bed. You had a mosquito net which you slept under. You didn't need blankets, you only needed the sheet. And, you know, it all seemed rather strange to start with, but it was all new to all of us. So we were, you know, in that particular position. After acclimatization, I think it was about three or four weeks, we then moved up into Malaya proper to north of Johor Bahru to the Far East training camp there, Far Elf camp, where we really started our jungle training. Again, the accommodation was similar, but by then we'd got used to it. We got used to the pouring rain in the afternoon, beautiful mornings, hot, steamy, and again in the evenings after having a shower. I think you sweated again with the heat till it gradually cooled down, I suppose, to about 75, 80 degrees by 10 o'clock at night.
What memories have you got of the kind of advice they gave you about operating in the jungle?
I think one of the things we quickly learned was to be quiet. Very little in the way of verbal orders were ever given. Even if they were, it was in a whisper. And we learnt our own sign language. Some of it was standard. Obviously, some was built up between you and your colleagues as to stopping, starting, listening, take cover. All those particular things we learnt. And if somebody's required, there was three fingers put on your arm requiring the platoon sergeant and two fingers on your epaulette wanting the platoon officer. So all that was there. With regard to training, I think a book was written, The Jungle is Neutral. It is. We quickly learn not to fight it, especially when moving through quite thick jungle. There's a typical plant which we named a wait-a-while plant, that the spikes were in the wrong direction. So if it, as you were moving forward, it got in your clothes and you tried to move forward even further, the spikes dug in your clothes, so you literally backed off. But again, we learnt to live in the jungle. We learnt better as we went on, obviously. They started by almost having to live at night on the ground to get into a routine. All this gradually changed as we became operational and got better equipment and moved literally from the ground up into the trees and in our hammocks, and life became quite bearable in that particular situation.
Were there any accidents in the training?
I believe not really accidents, no. We didn't have any accidents, anybody accidentally shot. But what we did on the good side of it was we actually killed a bandit on training, which was quite unique. There was only one other regiment out there that had done this. I didn't learn of this. I was out on patrol that particular day, and it wasn't until I got back to the base camp and met, you know, other colleagues there that they told me that they'd ambushed this or come upon this bandit and killed him. But there was no snake bites. I suppose the odd chap got a matchet across his top of his hand or that sort of thing, but nobody really got hurt that I can remember in all the training time.
What happened to you next?
After the end of the training, we moved then up to Kuala Lumpur by train at night. Again, quite an experience, because in those days the bandits sometimes mined the tracks. So in front of us was an engine with a truck, which preceded the train by about 5 or 10 minutes, and then obviously the train followed on behind. So if anything happened, in the way of mines or anything, the engine and its truck was going to get it. It did happen from time to time, but not very much from 54, 55. We got to Kuala Lumpur, we then got into trucks, and then we went to a place called Bentong, where we moved into a particular camp. What I can remember next is I went out on one operation where we moved through a small native village, and we were ambushing on the outskirts of it. Halfway through the morning, there was a bang, and everybody sort of, God, Lord, you know, it's going to happen. But what had happened, one of the lads was fiddling with his safety catch on an Owen gun, which was an Australian type of submachine gun, and he put his finger on the trigger and pulled the trigger, so he had an accidental discharge. So that ambush was immediately called off. Then 2 or 3 days later after that, I was then posted down to the Far East Training Centre at Kota Tinggi as a skilled arms instructor. I went as a corporal, and to prove myself after, I think, three or four weeks, I and another corporal, Corporal Coventry, were then promoted sergeant. We then stayed there for just over a year, training people in two aspects. We did a long 6-week course, almost equivalent to the small arms course at Hythe, and then we did a two-week jungle course for anyone in Malaya, and we had people from Hong Kong come down. We also had Fijians from the Fiji regiment out there, and I had the experience of two Burmese officers who came obviously from the Burmese army to do again the short course. And it was quite interesting listening to lessons taken in Burmese and Fijian from time to time. What happened to those Burmese officers, I'll never know. But so I really spent a year there.
What were the Fijians like in the jungle?
Excellent, excellent. They were all big chaps. They had a record of 210 kills and one capture. So one day we asked, why the only one capture? He said, well, there was a British officer with that patrol when they captured the bandit. From what I understand, they did have other captures, but they marched them from the jungle to the rubber, court-martialed them and shot them. Now, how true this is, I don't know, but we all understood that this is what they did. But we got to know a number of them very, very well indeed. In fact, I spent a weekend with them down at, I think, Batu Pahat was their camp, demonstrating the new self-loading rifle which we were issued with, and also sort of getting to know them very well.
You would have thought that such big chaps might not operate so well in jungle conditions.
No, they seem to adapt very well. I agree that having seen most of them, and they were big chaps, but they somehow got round it, and I say their record is second to none out there. You can't take that away from them, the 210 kills, which is an extremely good record for them.
But you trained them at Kota Tinggi, did you?
We had one or two come down, yes, corporals and so on, that we put them through, you know, the jungle training course, mainly, you know, shooting and getting to know the weapons more efficiently. And we found them very, very good indeed, extremely nice, affable sort of people who do anything for you. And also, while I was there, I had a Gurkha squad who used to be our fatigue squad. And they used to put out the targets and get the ammunition and you know, do all the cleaning up. And I always remember one small Gurkha, the name of Jug Bahadur Rai. I should never forget him. And I always knew that when I was working him too hard, he would come out with the phrase, "Sir, me no have 24 pairs of hands." And having heard that, I thought, you know, ease off a little bit. But when they lined up for their administration inspection, it was quite interesting to look at their medal ribbons with DCMs and MMs lining up in front of you, and they were our sort of fatigue squad. Another thing on the, we used to have the mounting the guard in the evening. Now, for the normal British soldier, if he can get off guard mounting, great. But the Gurkhas used to take it that it was an honour to be chosen to go on guard. And where we turned up in our jungle greens, which were not desperately creased and so on, they turned up in their starched items on parade. And it was an honour for them to go on guard at night. And that's your Gurkha soldier. I've got a great admiration for them. And also for the fact that where we drink rum and coke, they drink coke and rum. As I found out to my detriment one night and was rather ill in outside the Gurkha sergeant's mess, having again had a demonstration of this self-loading rifle. But again, you know, they are great soldiers.
Any other members of individual units which you had at Kota Tinggi to train?
Not really, just individual people. One incident, again, where I was wounded by a premature explosion of a grenade. I had a comrade in the Queen's Regiment, and it was one of those afternoons where you said, you know, cheerio, we're throwing grenades or firing grenades, won't see you again. And that afternoon, he said to me, "Do you want your squad to go first?" I said, "Yeah, I don't mind." So we duly had an officer of the Royal Hampshire Regiment, who'd never fired a grenade before, a Captain Hudson. He was the first up, so I prepared him, loaded the grenade, asked him if he was ready, and then I said, "Right, carry on, sir." There was a short pause, he obviously pressed the trigger, and the next thing I knew, there was a huge explosion in front of me. It felt like somebody had hit me right in the middle of the chest with their fist. I remember turning round, running about 5 yards, stopping, and then looking at my shirt, and suddenly, to my horror, there was blood everywhere. I remember turning round to the control tower where the officer was controlling the firing and saying, "Sir, I think I've been hit." The look of horror on his face when he came down that tower, well, it was quite something. I had no pain whatsoever, and I remember saying to him, "Well, I think I'd better lie down, sir." He said, "Yes, I think you'd better." So having laid down, they got the stretcher for me and got me back over a fairly rough track. It took about half an hour to get me back to the small first aid post at the Fire Elf Training Centre. Met the corporal. He said, "What have you done?" I said, "It's been a grenade accident." Again, I'd had no pain. So he opened the shirt and the blood had run round, obviously, from my chest to my back. So there was blood on the stretcher. And he immediately thought this grenade fragments had probably gone through me. So he had a quick look and no. He said, "No, you're all right." I said, "How long is this going to take?" He said, "About 3 weeks." So he put a bandage on my chest, put me in a ambulance down to Singapore. On the way down, I could feel a slight pain just when under my left nipple, and got into the hospital in Singapore. They duly x-rayed it, showed me the x-ray, because again, I had no real pain, I wasn't knocked out at all. And they said, "Ah, there it is." It was a piece of metal, I suppose, about 3/4 of an inch long by 1/4 of an inch across. Got me in the operating theatre. And I remember the surgeon saying, "Well, you're too near the explosion to give you a general anaesthetic." I thought, "Well, what are you going to do?" So he got a needle out, which looked about 4 foot long in those days. And he said, "What I'll do," he said, "I'll numb it and then take a pair of tweezers and go in through the entrance wound, get hold of the piece of metal and bring it out," which is what he did. Took me back into the hospital. And I think about 2 days later, they took me down, knocked me right out and then stitched it up. Again, I count myself lucky because the previous occupant of the first bed inside the door, which you all get when you come straight in, died. I lived. A week later, I was suddenly moved down a couple of beds and somebody was brought in who'd hit the back of a brick lorry on a motorcycle, I think a Royal Military policeman. He died. The next person to be brought into the bed actually lived, just because he'd taken accidentally a .38 revolver bullet in the back of the neck and he was paralysed and had to be literally turned. They were very good because they brought his Chinese girlfriend in and she stayed there and helped. They nearly lost him one morning because he vomited accidentally, but they managed to save him. And when I left the hospital, he was beginning to get movement back in his hands and legs. So what happened to him, I just don't know. But I think that was, you know, my main recollection of my year at the Fire Elf Training School.
And then?
They decided to close it, first of the redundancies, I suppose, and move us back to our regiment. I then returned to Kuala Lumpur, where the D Company, which I was posted to, was stationed. We covered the